Part of you.
Huh?
Part of you.
Part of me?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'll still be sending out the messages. That's not too hard. I got that down to a science now. I can get those out in 5 minutes. There's three. One goes to the Wild Reporter, one comes here, and one goes to all of you. Okay, so so next month we're going to have our meeting at Henry's house. It's going to be what Chad likes to call the Freethinkers Party, what Henry likes to call the Solstice Party, but it's coming right on the solstice, or almost. It's going to be December 20th. And the solstice is always either the 20th or the 21st. I'm not sure which it is this year.
I think it's the 21st.
Okay.
Yes, that's a friend.
So, and our discussion next month will be about the solstice, and I'll just be presenting. It's not going to be quite as long as a regular meeting, because it's a party. But what we'll be talking about is, I want to talk a little bit about the motions of the Earth and how it relates to calendars. Okay? So, you know, there's a lot of motions of the Earth. You probably can name two of them. It rotates on its axis and it revolves around the sun. But there are others. Anybody name one?
Vibration, maybe?
Well, there's the
precession. Precession of the equinox.
Precession. There's the bobbing up and down of the tilt of the axis. I'm sorry, the shape of the orbit changes. It becomes more circular and then more elliptic. And there's several.
Especially if we have gravitational waves.
Gravitational waves. Okay, well, that's a different subject. You're up on your latest science.
But, you know, does the Earth have vibration to, like, the moon, I suppose?
Well, the Earth vibrates.
Never mind.
The Earth vibrates. Every time there's an earthquake, it vibrates a little bit. Okay. What else? Is there anything else to say? We have a lot of new faces, but I think a lot of us are not going to be here next month, right? The three of you won't. Okay, so then we won't spend a lot of time with introductions because that wouldn't be as useful. Now, John presented a topic to me by email for consideration, and what I emailed back to him was that the last two slots this year are already filled, and so that's something to take up with Philip.
We'll just pass on to Philip. Pass on to Philip, or I can do it. Right?
You should deal with him directly.
Okay. Yeah.
John doesn't normally like to give the presentation himself. Earlier this year, he had another topic he wanted to do, but he didn't want to do the presentation and actually asked me to do it, and I felt that I couldn't present somebody else's topic. Because
it's a funny thing. I have tinnitus, and when I get a little excited, the tinnitus literally disables me. You know, I think my blood pressure is...
You don't have...
Because I used to lecture, regularly, and... I never had this problem.
But what we did with your last one, we made it just a written. We sent out an email, everybody read it. It wasn't presented in the meeting. If you have something you want to disseminate and you can't make the presentation or find someone to do it, we can do it that way.
No problem.
Okay, today, I was just kind of scrounging up for topics, and I sort of put two of them together. They're peripherally related. The first one is going to be about the scientific method. I just wanted to spend a moment talking about, because normally when people talk about the scientific method, they're talking about what goes on in the laboratory and what generates scientific papers. But really, the scientific method is much larger than that. It starts before that, and it goes long after that. So, in fact, what comes out of that smaller process, which I'll be calling the micro-scientific method, isn't even necessarily correct. A lot of papers have to be revised. They have to be validated. Sometimes they aren't. So what I'm talking about is the larger process by which science becomes settled science, the entire vetting process, which for a theory like the theory of evolution has been going on for a century and a half. Okay, that's the scientific method writ large. And then also what I wanted to talk about, because I didn't think that was enough material for a meeting, was what I call scientific prophecy. Now, I use the word deliberately. In science, they call it prediction. But I'm going to just basically compare it to religious philosophy, a rather religious prophecy, and show the difference between what is meant by high-quality prophecy and low-quality prophecy.
You want to contrast.
Well, you may have seen, I'll start with the quote at the end that I put in the email from Carl Sagan. It was going to be the last thing I read, but I'll read it now because it's relevant. Think how many religions attempt to validate themselves with prophecy. Think how many people rely on these prophecies, however vague, however unfulfilled, to support or prop up their beliefs. Yet has there ever been a religion with the prophetic accuracy and reliability of science? Okay, and that's going to be the second part of our discussion. So let me just get into this right away. Like I said, I'm going to be talking about two pieces of the scientific method, the lesser and the greater one that surrounds it, and is much longer. The scientific method is more than what the authors of scientific papers do to generate their findings. That is the method that they use within the laboratory or observatory to generate and analyze data. And that method is basically, we begin with observations, form a hypothesis, do some experiments, measurements, analysis, maybe modify the hypothesis, and either try to confirm the hypothesis if possible, or more likely disprove it. Yeah. In fact, when we talk about theories, one of the things they say about theories, and it also applies to hypotheses, they're different things. Sometimes the words are used interchangeably, but they shouldn't in a scientific context. I mean, we don't say, I have a theory in the sense, I have a hunch, or I have this guess. You know, in science, the word theory means something different. But that hunch or guess, we could call a hypothesis, and to be scientific, it has to be what?
Disprovable.
Yes, and the word that Popper used was falsifiable. What falsifiable means is, if your idea is wrong, there has to be at least in principle a way to demonstrate that. So if you make a statement that can't be disproven even if it's wrong, that's not a scientific statement. Okay? So like, for example, I think the hypothesis of abiogenesis is unfalsifiable, which is the idea that life evolved chemical evolution from things like amino acids into a living cell. I don't think there's any finding that could disprove that if it's wrong, except maybe find a creator. Can anybody think of a way that, if, let's suppose the idea is wrong. I happen to think it's right, but that's not the point. To call it a scientific idea, there has to at least be in principle a way to show that it's wrong if it's wrong, and I can't think of a way to do that. So I'm wondering whether that's even a scientific idea. It doesn't make it wrong, but it makes us think about these ideas. Okay, so let's call this other thing where...
Can I just...
Yes.
The test of reasonability?
I don't know that phrase.
Where does that... Well, let's say that, you know, Occam's razor says that, you know, the simplest explanation is the most likely. But if you apply that as being solid, mm-hmm. that the simplest explanation is always the most, then obviously mm-hmm. it's wrong. So, but there are some... There are some non-falsifiable theories that are so preposterous.
Like
or
what?
You could come up with
scientific theories that aren't falsifiable?
Well, no, okay, a theory, sorry. A theory that is so preposterous.
I just want to make sure you're not talking about a scientific theory. For our purposes...
But not like the biogenesis.
Okay, that's a hypothesis.
Yeah.
It's an idea somebody has.
Yes.
That this may have happened, and they're attempting to try to demonstrate that it's possible.
But there's an infinite number of possibilities, right? On what can happen. Where do you draw the line of reasonability?
I'm not sure exactly what you're asking.
There is a potential for that to be true.
Yes.
And you can imagine a potential for that.
Yes. And but my guess is it probably is true.
Yeah.
But I don't know any way to eliminate an intelligent designer from possibility. It's
exactly.
Logically possible.
And that's my point.
And so our candidate hypothesis list for the origin of life in the universe has to include... Hello. Jack, Bart, nice to see you both. So the candidate list of possibilities has to include both supernatural and natural explanations.
Yes.
And we can't rule either one in or out. But what we can do is order them in terms of likelihood using Occam's razor.
Yes.
The most parsimonious... explanation is going to be the preferred one. The simplest explanation that accounts for all the observable evidence is the preferred one. However, it might not be the right one, because more evidence may come along showing that the other idea actually explains all the evidence better. Okay. Any questions on any of that? Are we all pretty familiar with these kind of ideas?
Yes.
I hope. Okay, good.
What was the last question?
Are we all pretty familiar with these ideas? But you didn't hear a lot of them, so...
Oh, okay.
But you are.
So what I just described, I'm going to call the microscientific method just to have a name for it. And it generates papers. And the papers may be valid. They may not be. I don't know how many are familiar with like the statistical analysis of these findings, but you give a number, you give error measurements, plus or minus this or that, and then all you can say is it's 95% likely to be in that... or it's 90% likely, or it's whatever it is, and it just might be wrong. And a lot of people criticize that standard, we only have to be 95% likely. If you're familiar with statistics, they talk about a p-value of 0.05, which represents the other 5%. And that means that 1 out of 20 papers are giving us information that doesn't really reflect reality, but reflects a statistical aberration. So it's an interesting subject. maybe we need tighter standards. All right, now, the microscientific method is part of the larger vetting process, which is a communal function. It's not done by a scientist in a lab, but the scientific community. It's not science until it's vetted by this larger process. It's not cell science anyway. Studies are subject to peer review before implementation to decide if they are well designed and worth funding. So even before we start the laboratory phase, there's people looking at your design protocol and deciding whether it's statistically valid and whether this will generate real science and whether money should be devoted to this. That's even before you start. Then again afterward to decide if they are worthy of publication, peer review. So that's part of this process, also not going on in a laboratory, where the interested scientific community can then read these papers and comment on them. The studies are often repeated and either confirmed or in some cases disconfirmed and errors identified. And maybe the hypothesis has to be revised. Remember people came out with a paper on desktop nuclear fusion, cold nuclear fusion, a couple of years ago? There was another one where they thought they found something moving faster than light, a neutrino.
Oh, yeah, the neutrino, yeah. Yeah, and they disproved it.
But they went back and, you know, I mean, look, that's science. Those were papers. They were vetted. Yeah. They were peer-reviewed, and they were published, but then they were later invalidated.
Yeah,
so that's what I'm talking about, this bigger
part. Couldn't be duplicated.
Right. It wasn't reproducible. Okay, now here's more of this larger process. The results may then be used to develop technology that may be used to predict and in times control nature, which when this happens confirms the validity of the new science they contain. Okay? If you have an idea, we're going to talk about the Higgs boson. Actually, the gravity waves is the latest. I was going to say the Higgs boson is the latest, but gravity waves is the latest. These are predictions that come out of science. They were unexpected things, and they derived from the work that scientists did. And scientists said, well, if you look for this under these circumstances, you'll find it. Okay, when you can do that, I think you have pretty strong evidence that you have a good idea, that you have a valid idea. But still, it's not proof. Like I said, we can never really... They say you can never prove a scientific theory. But I have a problem with that. I would say the heliocentric theory is proven.
Yes.
And I would say the germ theory of infectious disease is proven.
Yeah. I think that Dawkins has, in one of his books, describes the two meanings of theory. And one is, you know, like the theory of evolution or the
scientific theory.
Heliocentric, yes. There are two different meanings for theory. And one is the scientific one.
And the other one is hypothesis.
And the other one is a hypothesis. Just
right,
a hypothesis.
And I'm trying to avoid using that word that way in this meeting.
Well, he actually came up with the word, yeah. But it hasn't caught on.
What was his word?
I don't remember. Okay. It's in one of his books.
That's why it hasn't caught on.
Yeah.
You seem to have a good background in science.
Actually, liberal arts, but
same thing.
Yeah, same thing.
Because
I love science. Exactly.
No, sort of the opposite. But I was kidding.
But yeah, through my education, science.
Okay.
Is
well, good for you. I'm glad you have an interest in this stuff. Okay, so now we've made predictions. Now, multiple related studies are brought together and used to generate scientific theories. From which previously unexpected predictions are made again, which have confirmed, further validates the conclusions. These include the scientific prophecies we will be discussing next. Okay? So, the theories may suggest new avenues of previously unconsidered exploration, which in turn may also bear fruit, such as additional useful technology, or suggest even more areas of investigation, further vetting the validity of the discoveries. So, for example, if you actually get to put your idea to work technologically and this bears fruit, that's more confirmation, isn't it? So we have ideas, say, coming from the theory of electricity that put to work very well. We have electric lights, and as soon as you can apply your idea and improve the human condition with it, whether that's a vaccine or an automobile or whatever it is that's making your life a little bit better, that's, to me, evidence that your idea is good. In fact, that's pretty much a sine qua non for me of a right idea. It works. If your idea doesn't work and it can't be used for anything, I have this discussion sometimes with my creationist friends, and I go, suppose intelligent design is right. Let's just say it's right, and theory of evolution is wrong. I can still make the theory of evolution work for me. I can't make intelligent design work at all. There's not one single thing I can do with that idea. I can't make a single prediction. I can't improve anybody's quality of life. That is a completely, even if true, useless idea. And to me, that's the sine qua non of a wrong idea. And that's why I reject it in part, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay. Okay, and with time, additional confirming observations using unrelated techniques may be added, as with evolutionary theory, where by the time of the middle 21st century, we had a revolution in genetics. And now that's evolved from just Watson and Crick's DNA structure to the Human Genome Project. And I just had my dog's DNA sequenced to find out what breeds they were. So we've come a long way with that. But what the genetic information has told us is just, it just confirms what we already thought, what we already believed. It's more, it's additional evidence of the same kind, in support of the same idea. There's an idea that goes by the name of consilience. I don't think it's a commonly used word. But it says when you have multiple pieces of evidence, each of which is only weak, but they all point in the same direction, then you have a strong argument. And the example I like to give is, if you take a tax return with one mistake on it, and the mistake is in the favor of the taxpayer, you don't really know whether that was an honest error or not. But if there's 23 mistakes and they're all in his favor, that's a cheater, okay? That's consilience.
Being smart.
No one of those mistakes makes a case. Right. And so what's the take-home message? If you're going to cheat on your taxes, do two or three of them the other way. We'll make you pay a little extra. If you want to be deceptive. All right. Okay, after years of such vetting, over which no contradictory observations have been made, only then is it fully vetted science. Information that gets as far as what is described above simply cannot be overturned. Let me ask you this. We have this huge mountain of evidence in support of the theory of evolution. We've got fossil evidence. We've got genetic evidence. We've got comparative anatomy, embryology. We've got biogeography, the distribution of organisms in the world and the ring species, and on it goes. All right. Suppose the theory could be falsified. How could we falsify this theory? The cliche example is to find the pre-Cambrian rabbit. Okay, in the pre-Cambrian era, there was nothing more advanced than a trilobite. There were no rabbits then. There were no people then. If you found convincing evidence that a rabbit existed then, the theory would be in trouble. Okay, if we found evidence that man had been on Earth for 3 billion years, the theory's in trouble. Right? Those would be disconfirming findings. What would you then do with that mountain of information and this one fact that shows that it doesn't mean what you thought it meant? What could it possibly mean if not what Darwin said it meant?
Could mean that we're wrong when we got the information that something is wrong. If you have this mountain of information that supports, you know, little by little, and then you have something that is totally different, that contradicts that mountain of information, maybe we have to look more carefully.
Well, we should. But what could possibly be the explanation that accounts for all of our evidence now? All the evidence we had before that made us so sure the theory of evolution was right, and this one piece now that tells us it's not.
You're discounting the human ability to rationalize.
Well, my answer...
It's difficult, but...
My answer is you have to turn to back to intelligent design and say that somebody planted all those fossils and rigged our DNA to look like evolution was true and either made a mistake or left us a little package to find and someday figure it out. I don't know what else could possibly be an explanation for all the evidence we have today plus a piece that disconfirms it. What else could you come up with? I have no other ideas. But anyway, that's why I say that theory is unassailable. It'll never be overturned. It can be tweaked. Darwin proposed gradualism, where the species evolved slowly over time, and later it was Gould who found that it actually progresses in fits and starts, so-called punctuated equilibrium, if you're familiar with that term, where evolution occurs quickly under certain circumstances and slowly after others. So like when a meteor hit the Earth and wiped out all the big reptiles, suddenly niches were open and all kinds of evolution occurred. And we had adaptive radiation of the mammals into the niches formerly occupied by the reptiles. Were you going to say something, Mark?
No.
Okay. So that's what I wanted to say about the scientific theory. And before, the scientific method, before we move on, is there anything that anybody wanted to discuss about that? I thought it was an interesting topic, I thought it was well worth the review, talking about some of these interesting ideas. I did want to say one thing about the abiogenesis project. I don't have much doubt they're going to eventually find a pathway, of the spontaneous evolution of a cell. But how are you going to demonstrate that that's the one that occurred so many billions of years ago? I don't think you can do that. And they may come up with several pathways. How are we going to identify which was the one? I think that that idea is an idea that, even though I believe is correct, it's going to have a future that's a little different from most scientific theories once it is raised to the stature of a theory.
By spontaneous, you don't really mean spontaneous, do you?
I mean undirected, still naturalistic.
It was still evolution.
Yeah, what I mean by spontaneous is not that it occurred quickly, but that it occurred without help. That it was just all thermodynamically downhill. Everything happened without, just like any other chemical reaction. You put the right chemicals together in the right circumstances, and they do the rest.
My understanding is evolution, you know, you have gradual evolution, and then you have mutation. And mutation is much more quickly. I mean, something mutates into something else that is so much better than everything else that it it catches on quickly. This would be in evolution. It would be spontaneous almost.
Okay.
Where you get a mutation that is suddenly catches on.
Yeah, I think.
Isn't evolution the mutation?
That's one of the methods of generating variation.
Two phases.
There's also gene shuffling and, you know, a few other kind of things like genetic drift. There's something called the founder principle, where just a handful of animals break off from the group, and they're not typical. They don't represent the whole sample they came from. Their relative proportion of alleles is different, and they go off and generate a different population that way. So now the animals have evolved, but without mutation.
And that happens rather quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know,
yeah.
I think that they have done studies with fish, and then they realize that they are separated, you know, like in the river, and they kind of evolve.
Yes, I used to be able to name that fish for you. I know the one you're talking about. Yeah. It's in a lake. It's several
levels. It's in a lake. It's several levels.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it happens rather quickly.
Yeah, good point. It was one species of fish it put in this lake. Some of them are down deep where it's darker and colder. Some are up higher, and they're now different species of these things, mm-hmm. just because they've been divided from each other.
Now, have you read anything about the... was it Lamarck that came up with the idea that within a generation you could influence future? Was it Lamarck who came with that?
What Lamarck said was that traits could start in the body and be sent to the genes.
Yes.
Darwin says the opposite.
Yes.
Yeah.
But wasn't there something about... I read something about... that it doesn't affect the genes, but the folding, the protein folding, that there is...
Well, there's more than just, code sequence. I don't know the genetics as well as I did a long time ago when there was less of it. But there's a word, epigenetic. You know
yes,
that
was it.
Okay, yeah, well, that's just talking about the way, it's a different way the genes express themselves that isn't necessarily based on code sequences.
Yeah.
Codons.
Yeah.
Okay, now we're going to consider a particular part of that larger process that I just described, confirming a scientific theory by using it to predict something not already known to be true, and then confirming the prediction. And we can call this scientific prophecy, and contrast it with biblical prophecy, which is often offered as evidence of superhuman prescience by biblical authors, which in turn is offered as evidence of a god, either directing their hand or inspiring their thoughts. To begin, let's distinguish between high-quality and low-quality prophecy. I think you can probably guess where this is going. I get this all the time. It was predicted that we would be despised. It's predicted that there would be earthquakes and whatever in the end times. That's low-quality prophecy. You pretty much start any new religion, you're going to have enemies. And, okay. High-quality prophecy is prophecy that is verified, specific, that is detailed and unambiguous, predicts something surprising and unlikely or unique, predictions that are not self-fulfilling, are not also accompanied by failed predictions or prophecies, is completely fulfilled, and predicts something that definitely occurred subsequently. I'll give you a lot of examples of things that meet and don't meet these criteria. Low quality prophecy, by contrast, is vague or unclear predictions, trivial predictions, such as it will be cold next winter. That's prophecy, but not very high quality. Self-fulfillable prophecy is low quality prophecy. We're often offered the reestablishment of Israel as an example of fulfilled biblical prophecy. How could they possibly have known back then that that was going to happen today? How many countries that disappear from the world come back? Well, when your Bible tells you that it better come back for the end times, you're going to make it happen. And that's self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah, it's just not. Let's see, where was I? Unverifiable prior prophecy, such as that the legendary Jesus would fulfill certain criteria. Okay, Jesus comes along, and they go back after the fact and say, "Well, he fulfilled the prophecy." Of course, the prophecy says his name will be Emmanuel, and that he will be a military leader, and he will bring peace to the earth. And so, that's not really high quality prophecy either, because much of that didn't actually happen. Okay, and here's an example of what I consider a real weak prophecy. Biblical prophecies such as the one in Daniel 2:31 through 48, where Daniel interprets the prophetic meaning of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, are an example of something too vague to be considered any kind of prophecy. You can go read the scripture yourself. What you're going to find is about a huge, horrific-looking, immense, man-like figure made of clay, iron, brass. Anybody know this story? Nebuchadnezzar's dream, Daniel interpreted for him. It's made of brass, silver, and gold, which was pulverized to dust by a stone that became a huge mountain and was then carried away by the wind.
Wow.
Okay, and Daniel told him this.
Interpreted the dream?
Hmm?
He interpreted the dream.
And today they say, well, that was fulfilled with the Soviet Union and
different countries.
How do you get from this big monster of gold and clay to modern history? I don't know, but that's a real weak correlation right there. And then how about the numerology games? These are also weak prophecies. Have you seen any of these? There's one that says that they predicted the year 1948 that Israel would be reestablished. Anybody seen that one?
No.
It comes out of Ezekiel. I'm gonna show you this line of logic. I'm not going to give you all of it. But then God said to Ezekiel, "Now lie on your left side for 390 days to show Israel," that was 10 tribes, "will be punished for 390 years by captivity and doom. Each day you lie there represents a year of punishment ahead for Israel. Afterwards, turn over and lay on your right side for 40 days to signify the years of Judah's punishment." That's the other two tribes. Each day will represent 1 year. Okay, so we have 390 days and 40 days. We have 430 days, and that's now going to be, we're going to be told that represents 430 years of suffering. However, the author decides to subtract 70 from that figure because of the first 70 years of the Babylonian captivity. So, this is all ad hoc. So he goes from 430, and he takes this now down to, 360. However, now there's another scripture in Leviticus, time serves, right? There's another scripture in Leviticus that says, "And after all this, if you do not obey me, then I, God, will punish you 7 times more for your sins."
Wow. Sure.
Okay, so we're going to multiply the 360 by 7 now. And it's 2,520 years of punishment, or 902,700 days. Now, they decide to use a 360-day calendar, which is neither our calendar nor the Hebrew calendar.
Right.
But if you use a 360-day calendar, you can make it end up 1948.
And I thought it worked backwards from 1948.
Yeah.
Well, that's what it did. They started with 1948 and retrofitted an argument to make it look like this was prophesied. But had it been prophesied, they'd have known it was coming in 1948 since Ezekiel and Leviticus, wouldn't they?
Right, right.
But that's low-quality prophecy. Okay. A lot of good examples of it. Now, here's one from a movie. Does anybody remember a movie called Frequency?
Frequency.
It had Dennis Quaid and I think James Cavill.
What time period was that?
Maybe about 20, 25 years ago.
About
when? Their father and son, and their ham radio fans, and somehow the son from the future is able to speak to his father in the past through a ham radio. And he's going to try to convince him, that he has knowledge of the future. It's his present. But this is high-quality prophecy, okay?
I did see that.
Do you remember the scene?
Hollywood.
I remember the scene. It's in a bar. Do you remember what it's about?
No.
The World Series, the Mets.
Oh, yeah. He
says, going
to win. He goes, Pop, well, game five is the big one. It turned in the bottom, and his father's in the bar, and the game is about to come on. It hasn't been played yet. Okay, well, game five was the big one. It turned in the bottom of the sixth. We were down 3-0. Cleon Jones gets hit on the foot. Left a scuff mark on the ball. You may even remember that. That was pretty famous. Clendenin comes up. The count goes to 2-2. High fastball. He nailed it. Weiss slammed a solo shot in the seventh to tie. Jones and Swoboda scored in the eighth. We won, Pop. Okay, now he watches this happen on TV. That's high-quality prophecy right there. Okay? Because it's specific. Right. It's detailed. Yeah. It's unambiguous. It definitely happened before the fact, and it wasn't a self-fulfilling prophecy. It meets all the criteria for high-quality prophecy. And, of course, it's magic. But science can do this.
Well, in the movie, was that to convince his dad of the...
Then it was really him.
...the really thing, and then does he have his dad go bet on these games, or what?
No, but he does say, Dad, buy Yahoo. And Dad goes, what's that? He goes, you don't have to know.
Do it.
Yeah. So it is a little insider trading, but we'll give it to them for the movie. All right, now let's talk about some scientific prophecies. I'm going to give them to you. I actually don't have gravity waves on here, but that's the latest one that was predicted and confirmed. Einstein prophesied the bending of light grazing past the sun. Okay, that wasn't expected. Nobody thought that light was... photons have no mass, so they shouldn't be affected by gravity. And his theory said that it would be. But how do you go demonstrating something like that? Does anybody know the experiment?
So when he went on a ship and then...
Yes, he didn't go himself. Eddington
and
went.
He expected to see a certain star in certain positions.
Exactly. But it had to be during what?
An eclipse.
Right, because what you're looking for is when you know the position of a star is actually this far from the sun. Now, in the daytime, you're not going to see that star. Yeah. So in order to see it in the day, there has to be an eclipse blocking the sun out. But they knew exactly where that star should have been if light wasn't being bent. But the light was being bent, so it appeared a little closer to the sun than would have been expected. But the theory did expect it. And that's how they confirmed the theory of relativity. Einstein prophesied the bending of light grazing past the sun. Such was the confidence in the priests of science that a fleet of ships was sent to various locations around the world to confirm the prophecy in 1919. It made headlines. And a little interesting history is they would have liked to have done it sooner, but there was a world war going on.
All right.
They had to wait for it to end before they could safely go out in the middle of the ocean and do these kind of observations. So it's a real nice story. Okay, 25 years later, the scientists did it again. Quantum electrodynamics is the study of how electrons and photons interact. The predictions of QED regarding the scattering of photons and electrons are accurate to 11 decimal places. Okay, a number was generated by this theory that such and such a dimension or physical constant would be, and they gave 11 digits. And they found it to be exactly that. That's pretty impressive.
Yes.
That's pretty specific. Okay, the Big Bang Theory generated a couple of predictions of what should be seen if the theory were correct. One such prediction, does anybody know either of them?
Would that be the expansion of the universe?
Well, the Big Bang Theory was developed after the expansion of the universe was identified. That was it. Yeah, right. Hubble's evidence was led to two competing theories, the one that ended up Lemaître's theory, Big Bang, and Hoyle's theory, the steady-state theory, they were competing with one another. But one difference between the two theories is that the Big Bang predicted that there would be something called the cosmic background.
Yeah.
The microwave,
yeah.
Okay. What happened was the universe was very hot and dense and glowing, and it was opaque. If anybody had been around at that time, you couldn't see anything. It would be like being in lava. It would be glowing. It's lit. but it's opaque. And photons just can't move around in that. They get stuck like they do in the sun. You know, it takes them about a million years to get from the core of the sun to the surface.
Yeah.
They predicted that eventually the universe would cool. And this former substance was a plasma. The protons, the nuclei and the electrons were separated from each other. When the universe cooled enough, they formed neutral atoms. And at that point in time, that matter and energy decoupled, and the universe became transparent. Dark. We still didn't have stars yet. It went from light to dark. It didn't get light again until the galaxies and stars evolved. But they predicted that if this theory is correct, that happened, and there should be microwave. They call it microwave. It's electromagnetic energy at a very long wavelength and low energy. They corresponded to a temperature of about 2.7 degrees of about equal intensity in every direction. That was a prediction. Okay, and I'll read you a little bit about this now. The Big Bang Theory generated several predictions of what should be seen if the theory were correct. One such prediction made by Ralph Alpher, Robert Herman, and George Gamow, doing theoretical work on primeval nucleosynthesis in 1948, is that the cosmic microwave background would be found. If all the energy and matter did start expanding from a single point, then there had to be a time a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang where the energy dissipated to the point that stable atoms were formed, neutral atoms, and the opaque plasma that filled all of space became a transparent gas instead of a plasma fog. The result of such an event would be that large amounts of light could then travel freely through space. Over time and with subsequent expansion and cooling, the wavelength of these photons expanded and they fell into the microwave range. The theory predicts the energy that this light should have had both then and now, which is the same as the spectrum of microwaves emitted by a 2.75 degree Kelvin blackbody. I guess it's getting a little technical here, but it's just a real low energy light, not really literally light like you can see it. The theory also states that this cosmic microwave background should be coming at us from every direction at a specific intensity, so many photons per second, and it should be we should be able to observe it right now. In 1965, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson at the Bell Telephone Laboratories in Murray Hill, New Jersey, found the cosmic microwave background by accident. They were building radio telescopes, big funnel-like things, and they just there was this ambient noise coming from every direction that they just couldn't get rid of. And so they did everything in their power. They swept everything out. They swept out the pigeon excrement. They on and on and on they went. They just could not make this background radiation go away no matter what they did. And right up the road, they're in Princeton, and right up the road are the theoretical scientists saying, I think these guys just found the cosmic microwave background. And I'll tell you something else that's kind of interesting about that ambient radiation. It's in this room right now. You have seen it. Do you know when?
Television, I don't know. When
yes.
The snow.
Yes, exactly.
That's
when,
what we call
that
it.
Snow you saw on television when you were a kid, that's the microwave background radiation. Good. You get a lot of questions right. Okay. Now, there was another prediction that came out of that theory. They said, well, if the universe is did what we thought it did, there should have been an era of nucleosynthesis when hydrogen nuclei and helium nuclei were formed, and a couple of lithium and beryllium, but not much of that, some deuterium. And they said pristine, you know, primeval clouds of gas in the universe should have something like 78% hydrogen, 22% helium, you know, whatever the numbers were. I don't exactly know them. And then this was found too. So that tells you the theory is correct. Although the theory still could use some tweaking, because the theory projects all the way back to a time when the universe had no size, no dimension at all. That's not necessarily the case. And maybe the universe started something very small. We don't really know. We can't definitely extrapolate that far back. So, but what we do know is that an expansion event took place about 13.8 billion years ago, and these prophecies, predictions, confirm that the idea that the scientists have is largely correct, even though, like I said, some of it may need to be tweaked a little bit. So this other prediction I just told you about, and then finally, I wanted to tell you about the Higgs boson. So based on that excellent reputation of prophecy that had come before, billions were allocated to look for the Higgs particle. You may or may not remember all this stuff. They called it the God particle. And it was the particle that a physicist named Higgs hypothesized should exist, and it was the one that gave other particles mass. But it was that it took such high energies to generate this particle that it wasn't possible to do on Earth until they developed the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. So based on that excellent reputation, billions were allocated to look for the Higgs particle, with which the scientists built a fine machine, CERN's Large Hadron Collider, to look where man had never looked before, except in his rich imagination. Sounding like Star Trek now. And lo and behold, I like to use the religious language, and lo and behold, a particle was born, Higgs. The prophets were correct again. And then I finished with biblical prophecy, just can't compete with any of that. And then the second quote that you've already heard. So that was the presentation. What can we discuss?
Well, I would just like to mention about the latest
prediction, okay.
I guess, or prophecy. They're high quality, and that would be the gravitational waves that were predicted by Einstein 100 right. years ago last year, and then they discovered them.
Yes.
And my husband and I had the opportunity to go to the laser interferometer gravitational observatory.
Really? LIGO.
In LIGO, yes, in Washington.
Uh-huh.
Yes, very interesting.
Well, I really admire your interest in science. That's great, because I don't think a lot of people care about this stuff. And what's going on around us is really amazing.
Good yes, it's
what she's talking about is a couple of neutron stars collided mm-hmm. and sent out gravitational waves. And I'm not really up to speed on this, except that I know that the gravitational waves were predicted to move at the speed of light. And light came about the same time as the gravitational waves, correct?
Yes, and they're
confirming that aspect of theory. Not only that they're there, but that they move at the speed of light, which suggests that gravitons are massless.
Yes, and they have to have two of these observatories. So they have one in Louisiana and one here in South Sudan. When the gravitational wave hits the Earth, you know, they can detect it, let's say, in Louisiana and then in Washington, and, you know, they can measure it.
Right.
And yes, and it's a very sophisticated equipment that they have. Very, very interesting.
Yes. So anyway, I'm very proud of our species.
Yes.
Look what we've done.
Well, yes. We kind of go from very low to very high, you know.
Yeah, we have a wide range.
Right
yes. now, you know, there's the worst side of humanity is
but
all over the news.
We're evolving to morally, ethically.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, so we have hope.
Just look at the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament. You can see a lot
yes,
of that evolution
right there. Right
yeah.
there, all the
and then the difference between the New Testament and, say, modern moral theory.
Yeah, humanism.
Right. Yes. Well, I don't see democracy anywhere in the New Testament, you know, or I don't see guaranteed personal human rights anywhere in the, you know, those are, I don't see the abolition of slavery. I see them advocating rape. But still, the New Testament was a big jump forward from the Old Testament.
Very big jump, yes.
Where the ethics were just older. And we can't really condemn those people, I don't think. They just hadn't evolved as much culturally. Again, I find it interesting when I'm having these discussions with people, they're saying, well, naturally it should be older. People didn't know as much then. I said, yeah, but you told me this came from a god. The god didn't evolve, did it? I mean, this is evidence of man evolving, not of something coming from a god. And I hope I haven't offended anybody's religious sensitivities here. I don't know what everybody believes. I already mentioned that I'm an atheist. But if there are believers here and I've offended you, I apologize.
What about theoretical physics and the scientific method?
Purely theoretical physics?
Yeah.
And it doesn't have a basis in experiment yet?
Yeah.
Like the multiverse?
Yeah.
Well, I call it a hypothesis.
I don't know how to evaluate the validity of these theories, because they appear to be non-falsifiable.
Like
but
the
they
multiverse,
seem to be.
The multiverse may be like abiogenesis. It may be a fact, and it may never be possible to demonstrate that.
Yeah.
But I still would. I would just advise against using the word theory to talk about a hypothesis.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, a hypothesis. Yeah.
The multiverse hypothesis. What's nice about the multiverse hypothesis is, of all the hypotheses that there are for the origin of the universe, it and intelligent design are the only two that account for the fine-tuning argument, which you may know.
So far.
So far.
So far.
Well, the ones we have.
Yeah.
And that's why those two theories actually, I mean, there's some argument. Do you know what I'm talking about with the fine-tuning argument? The fine-tuning argument goes like this, that the ratio of the charge and mass of an electron is one of the fundamental constants of the universe. The speed of light is one of the fundamental constants of the universe. There are several, Planck's constant. All of these various numbers, they say, if they were a little different, our universe wouldn't be stable. We wouldn't have had billions of years for the matter in the universe to evolve into galaxies and stars, or for life to have evolved on this planet, or for consciousness to have evolved into life. In order for those kind of things to happen, you have to have a universe that's relatively stable. And there are the ideas that many other universes might have been possible, and that they might not have been stable. And I don't know if that's a valid argument, because some people say, we don't know for sure that it could have been any other way. It might have been that all universes turn into this one. I don't know. But let's just give credence to the argument that that suggests an intelligent designer. Well, the multiverse hypothesis accounts for that as well, because the multiverse is this unconscious, amorphous something that generates every kind of universe possible, including this kind. So we would expect uncountable numbers of this kind of universe and uncountable numbers of every other kind of universe to exist. And in the ones like this, there would be creatures like us having these conversations, and the others might only have just done this. You know, we don't know what their fates were, but those are the two hypotheses that account for the fine-tuning argument, and which one's better? Well, if we go back to Occam's razor, the multiverse is the simpler one. It doesn't require a conscious agent with intention. The God hypothesis does. So either one could be right in the sense that they're both logically possible, and either one can be ruled in and ruled out. As Henry says, there may be other ideas coming down the pike later. But again, we talked about candidate hypotheses for the origin of life in the universe. Now we can talk about candidate hypotheses for the existence of the universe. And the multiverse is the top one on my list. Well, there's other ideas, that the universe just formed out of nothing from nothing, and there is nothing else but our universe. These are all kind of hard ideas, because, you know, every one of these ideas requires that either something came from nothing, or that something has always existed infinitely back into time. And those are two very hard ideas to work with.
Mind-boggling ideas.
Well, if there's something here now, whether this is the first thing that ever was, this universe, or something that created this universe came before it, like a multiverse or a god, whatever we say is the primary source of everything, it either has always existed, or it came into being from nothing. And both of those ideas seem logically impossible, yet it seems like one of them must be correct. That's an interesting idea, I think. Anything else we'd like to talk about? How are we doing for time?
10:05.
Uh-oh. I got a vamp.
Vamp for a second because I just lost where I was.
Well, you had been talking about the multiverse as a hypothesis that might not be confirmable or
disconfirmable. Yeah, I was thinking about the... Our understanding is pretty limited, right? And our ability to understand is pretty limited.
Probably.
And people have said, well, what happened before, you know, time started when, you know, the Big Bang. What happened before then? But if there, it's an impossible question to ask.
Yes, it's not a well-formed question.
Yes, because if time started this week, just because we cannot envision a moment when time did not exist. You know, how do we imagine that moment?
I can't imagine infinite time, and I can't imagine time starting. Yeah. They're both impossible ideas.
Well, it's beyond our comprehension at the moment, then.
Yeah. Well, we don't comprehend it, yes.
And the question becomes, how then do we acknowledge our limitation when we're explaining phenomena?
Does anybody know what I meant by the question is ill-formed? What happened before time? Well, the word before implies time.
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A real nice analogy is the southernmost point on the Earth is the South Pole. What's south of the South Pole? Well, that's a meaningless question. There's nothing south of the South Pole. You go in any direction of the South Pole, you're going north.
Okay.
So it's that kind of thing. So if we go back to the first moment, there's no before. Since we have a lot of time, I'll bring up another interesting idea, I think. Again, in these religious discussions that I have with people, they talk about God existing outside of time and space. Well, what does it mean to exist outside of time? I'm going to suggest that's another ill-formed concept. Because existence implies persistence through time. If something doesn't have a time and a place to be, a consecutive set of moments that it exists, then what are we saying when we say something exists? If God exists outside of the universe, he exists in another time. And furthermore, if he can do creative acts, so first there was no universe, then there was the universe, that's a before and after too. In fact, anything God does takes time. If God thinks, if God creates, all of those verbs imply the passage of time. All of them do. So we can start to unpack these wrong ideas about God living outside of time and space, or what happened before time. The ideas aren't really, they're not even valid questions.
I think the Christians would tell you that God is outside of time. That it's, God is a concept that you don't understand. You can't comprehend. It's not, God is not regulated by the laws of physics. And that's what they would say to them.
Okay. And I would argue that God must be regulated by some laws. Otherwise, he would just dissipate. He would forget everything.
They would say he makes those laws.
But there's a problem with that, too. How do you make the laws that bring yourself into existence? You know, those are, or that sustain yourself. Those are just...
Or they can say God always existed, but then again, you have the word always, you know, which implies time.
I'll give them that. If time goes back infinitely, then we can say God always existed, but he does exist in some time, a metatime. Mm-hmm. Our time had a first moment on that timeline, which wasn't its first moment. Mm-hmm. Right? If our universe formed and it was at such and such a point in time in God's perspective, but it was our first moment, then we have like two clocks running, two stopwatches, and ours starts later.
Yeah.
So we might have had a first moment, but it's pretty hard to imagine there was a first moment in time.
Has there ever been an argument or a response that has impressed you or give you, I mean, by impress, I mean give you more than a second to think that before you reply?
Well, some of the answers are better than others. Some there's just no, there's no interest in rigor.
Just
magical thinking.
Yes,
But some have some better ideas, but I've never seen any that that I thought were good ideas. I'm trying to think. That can't be true. I must have seen some good ideas.
The fine-tuning is the most common one if you see a debate.
Yeah.
Theist versus atheist.
There's another argument against God coming out of the fine-tuning argument, and it's this. What kind of God needs to fine-tune the universe? What kind of God needs to fine-tune the universe?
Oh.
What kind of God even needs a law of gravity? He just wills the planets around. They do what he wants. You know what needs laws? A godless universe. So I find that when it's offered as an argument for God, I find it as an argument against God. Another argument for God that falls apart is that a cell is just too complicated to have organized itself spontaneously. It's just too complex to exist uncreated and undesigned.
The development of the eye. That's the question.
Okay, let's take that. The cell or anything out of biology. Okay, so what's your solution to the idea that a cell cannot exist uncreated and undesigned? You're going to posit a God that exists uncreated and undesigned to explain a cell? You're just making the problem harder. Oh, there's a lot of these. They're fun. And that's why I spend so much time doing it, because I really enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. So you have always been an atheist?
I was raised an atheist. At about age 20, I found Jesus.
Oh, my goodness.
For most of a decade.
Didn't know he was lost.
And I was, I was a very devoted Christian. I was the kind of guy who stood on the corner passing out tracts. I was the guy that tried to get strangers to come to my church. I was the guy who went to church three times a week, Sunday morning, Sunday evening, and Wednesday evening.
Which kind of Christianity?
They were Pentecostals, speaking in tongues.
Oh, wow.
I had nothing to compare. I had nothing to compare it to. Oh,
wow. You got nothing over us Mormons.
Okay, but I'm really glad for that experience. One tragic thing came out of it, and I really learned what the problem is with faith-based thinking. And I guess maybe I'm using too strong a word when I say tragedy, but I got married based on faith. I was in the Army at the time, and so was the woman I married. She was a WAC. We hardly knew each other, but we both went to the same church. And I remember sitting on the steps of her barracks with her. We were outside. And you know crepuscular rays are? The sun rays that come out of the clouds like this? And I looked and I saw that, and suddenly I had the idea that I was being told to marry this woman. And I did it. Bad way to choose a wife.
How did you?
Magical thinking. You've done mystical thinking real good.
I did magical thinking. I did faith-based thinking. I suspended disbelief. I did everything.
How did you suddenly become a Christian? I mean, what happened that made you suddenly?
You want to know that part too? Okay, since we got time, I'll tell you. I wanted to be a doctor. I always had wanted to be a doctor, and I got to college a little young and fell on my face. And after a year and a half at UCLA, I was about ready to flunk out. And this created an awful lot of angst for me, because I just didn't have the discipline to do better, and I knew that I was hurting myself. And so I dropped out of school and joined the Army, because I wanted to add a little structure and discipline to my life. Well, that was actually a good move. But it increased my pain even more, because suddenly I'm in basic training with people like I've never known before, never had to live with before. People that will kick your ass for looking at you cross-eyed. My world was a little more genteel than that. And I was far from home. And I was at my wit's end. And there's two times in your life when you're most vulnerable to religion. Number one, before you develop critical thinking skills when you're a child, and number two, when you're in great distress. Which is why I like to say you will get more converts on death row and skid row than on restaurant row. Because those people are ready for you.
Yeah.
And there I was. But eventually, you know, two things happened. One is I started to see that the promises of Christianity weren't being kept. I couldn't move mountains with faith. I wasn't getting the victory. All the stuff that we were promised. The promises just weren't being kept. Eventually I got discharged from the Army. Well, one thing I want to add to you was, just by out of luck, I ended up in a great congregation. The first and only one I'd been in during the Army. And my pastor was really, a guy that I would say was spiritually blessed. I'll even use that language today. He made those people happy and fervent. And I thought that was the Holy Spirit. Because we had a presence in our congregation that was very rich and real. But when I discharged from the Army and started going from church to church to church and could never reproduce that again, I realized it was the pastor, not a Holy Ghost. And then the other thing that happened was I finally got my life together. And I developed the maturity. I got married, had a couple of kids. It wasn't a happy marriage. And it wasn't a happy divorce. But I was able to settle down and do the things I wanted to do, and I did get into medical school, and had a nice career as a physician, and I owe a lot of that to the time in both the military and the church. So I have nothing to complain about, except for that marriage. I'll confide in you why that's such an issue now. It's not because she and I aren't together anymore. It's because she poisoned the children against me. And I've never had a relationship with my children because of that.
Yes.
I have two children who don't know me, and I don't know them.
Yes.
And
that's very
tragic. Goes back to that faith-based thinking. Yeah, it is tragic. Yes. It's one of the couple of regrets in my life.
Mm-hmm.
They're not regrets for things that I necessarily did. I mean, I didn't know better than that. I'll tell you what the others are. Watching my country die. And this global warming nonsense. Those are all pressing matters for me. but nothing I can do about any of them. But those are the only regrets I have. You know?
And that's why some of us start off as passive atheists, become more aggressive atheists, because the feeling that religion is harmful to society.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Since you have this unique perspective of both sides, I'm curious what your opinion is why humans as a whole have created religions, no matter what the civilization, or why we are so susceptible to these kinds of beliefs to modern society that way.
I can share Dawkins' idea with you.
Please.
He says that human instincts have been co-opted. We have, by religion. So some people say we have a religion instinct or a God gene, but what Dawkins says is, no, there's something else in us that evolved for a different purpose that organized religion was able to tap into. One is our innate tendency to see things hierarchically, of there being the father figure, of it being authoritarian. And the other is the idea of agenticity, which is that things that happen in the world happen because something makes, something thinking makes them happen.
Some reason behind it.
Yeah, agenticity is why the ancients thought that Apollo was dragging the sun across the sky, okay, or why Thor was throwing lightning bolts down, because they just didn't really have a concept of the things happening on their own. And the animals are like that too, the beasts, and it's a survival mechanism. So you're in the forest and you hear a crunch, and you can't see it, better to assume that something thinking did that and either go hunt it down or run away from it than to assume otherwise. So, and here's the example Dawkins gives. He talks about why moths circle into a flame or a light bulb. The reason is they navigate using distant light sources at night. And in the time that they evolved, that was always the moon. And the moon is so far away that all the rays are parallel, practically speaking. So they've got a navigation system that's based on these parallel rays, and now they find themselves in a world with diverging rays. And it screws up their navigation system, and they just circle into the flame. And so, because the question is, why would moths evolve to do that? Well, they didn't.
They didn't.
No, their world changed.
Their world changed.
Right, and that's his answer to why we have so much religion. Because, and it's also in support of that is, religions need to keep people in a kind of a juvenile state. They need to keep, well, it needs, they need
control
to keep.
Control really is,
right.
You know.
What's that?
It's for control.
Right.
Yeah.
It answers difficult questions. with wrong answers. You know, why are we here? What are we doing? All the difficult questions gives them answers.
They want to believe there's something after death. They want to believe that.
They want to believe.
That's a big encouragement to believe in a religion.
Right. How did we get here? Why are we here? What are we doing? Religion answers all of those
questions. But I think that eventually we will evolve from that too, because Dawkins also talks about the God of the gaps.
Yeah.
You know, that as you know that what happens, you know, what the lightning, okay, so it wasn't Zeus or Thor, you know.
Right.
So I think that eventually, I don't know.
Why did my mother die? I mean, it answers all of those questions.
Will I see her again?
Will I see her again?
Yes.
When will I see her?
Who will protect me on my walk through?
All of those questions are answered.
Who loves me?
By this priest. All you have to do is bow down.
But the other thing that was interesting is the people who start religion. I mean, they got to be smart enough to figure all these things out in ancient times, you know, that people needed this stuff.
Right.
Well, I think there was a bottom-up and a top-down development. The bottom-down one is, I mean, the bottom-up one is organic. It's just people trying to answer questions and something we would all do ourselves. But the top-down one is other people recognizing this as exploitable.
And you've got a guy with orange hair who says, I have all the answers.
We're non-political.
The what?
It
has developed many eras when life was nasty, short, and brutish.
Right.
Yeah.
And people needed some way, something to get them through that this, it's not going to be this bad. Somehow things are going to get better for
things
me.
Are going to get better.
And
right.
That's the value that religion contributed.
Right.
You have something.
Hope.
If you're good, you go to heaven. If you follow the rules of whatever God it is that you're dealing with, your life will become better. You won't suffer hunger and thirst. And
send me your virgins.
Pain.
I'll send you two of them.
Well, for me, James Michener, American writer, wrote a very clearly for me in a very simple little story in one of his books called Source, whereby 20,000 years ago, there was a group of people who lived there, hunter-gatherers, going out doing their thing, came across a group of other people. They didn't know them until they had a fight. When the fight was over, they managed to capture a woman from the other group. But she taught them skills where she used to collect wild seeds and then plant them in the ground, water them, and she would grow wild wheat. This was the beginning of farming, according to him. However, oftentimes, when her seeds were in the ground and there wasn't enough rain, her seeds would dry and go away. Other times, there was too much rain. But all she could see was it was coming from the sky. She didn't understand weather systems, of course, in those times. So she thought that somebody up there was displeased with her and would either allow her crop to grow or not. So what she do, being fallible and being human, she would go down and put a piece of meat on a rock and say, that's for yourself. Please let your crops go. And that was the beginning of religion.
Yeah,
that makes sense to me.
That's the organic form of it they're talking about, the bottom up.
Yeah. Yes.
That's an ordinary person trying to understand her world.
Exactly.
But then along is going to come some guy that doesn't want to have to work.
That's right.
That wants instant respect and social status.
Yeah. And the offerings.
We weren't going to talk religion or politics.
That's the most fun.
No, but come on.
My wife and I are watching The Tudors now. I don't know if anybody's seen that series.
Nobody speaks the language of God.
What's that?
We're all looking for an interpreter. Okay. So if somebody comes along and says, I know how to communicate. I can communicate with the spirit. I can talk to the dead. I can talk to whoever in hell it is. And he becomes a spiritual leader.
It's a great job.
Yeah, exactly.
No manual labor. You're not outside. I mean, even today, you don't need a degree. You don't need insurance. You don't need a certificate. You don't.
Just the gift of gab.
You just need a building.
This is blasphemy.
You don't need
insurance.
There is a movie called The Invention of Lying. Have you seen it?
Yes.
The Invention of Lying, yes.
Yeah, with Ricky Gervais.
Yes, that talks about the kind of like the invention in a way of religion.
Right. Yeah, the first guy to think of lying. I think that came earlier.
Agriculture, and we started out with that.
Well, what I was going to say about a scene I saw from The Tudors last night. You know, I just commented, you know, I don't know if you remember, but Thomas More was the chancellor. And there was a heretic that he burned at the stake in the show. And both of them did what they did based on faith. This man that was going to be burned at the stake was given a chance to recant, if he would, but his faith caused him to make a bad choice. He just decided to stand there and be burned alive. And this other man that did it would have never done that without his religious faith. There'd be no reason to do that.
No doubt.
Right. So both of their lives were horribly damaged by faith. Mm-hmm. And I'm a real strong opposite of advocate when it comes to faith. I mean, well, what I say is this. How could faith possibly be a path to truth if you can believe any idea or its opposite by faith? At least one of those ideas, if not both, are wrong. So how's that a path to truth? Furthermore, if you happen to guess something correctly by faith, you can't know that until a non-faith method confirms it. You need evidence and reason to show that you were right all along.
Do you ever ask your Christian friends why they have lightning conductors on steeples on churches?
Why the Pope Mobile is bulletproofed?
Exactly.
Crises in faith all. Well.
Yeah, it was interesting for sure.
Are we done?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, now we get some more questions, and now we can talk about religion and politics.
Now we can talk about politics if you want.
Okay,
let's get well, we can stay and discuss anything anybody wants. But if we're done talking, then it's probably time to get up and go.
I have a question.
I
was going to ask you if you wanted me to give you the word that Richard Dawkins uses instead, the theory, instead of theory, I could okay. Email it to you. It's going to take a little while, and if you want to, I can do that.
Sure. I'm going to guess it's a word I've heard, like hypothesis or conjecture or something like that. Is it a word he invented?
Well, he invented the word.
Oh, then I probably haven't heard it.
What word was that?
She can't remember, but when she does, she's going to let me know.
In March, when I go back to the States.
Whenever.
To my books.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you will let us know.
Okay, as soon as I find out.
The question I had was for next year. And the idea of inviting people with different opinions willing to come and...
The lion's den?
Yes.
Into the lion.
By different opinions, you mean religious people?
Either that or conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
Who, you know, we all like evidence-based facts. Why is their evidence different from ours? At the same... You know, why is a... we're both exposed to the same facts. Why is their interpretation different?
Last month we talked about confirmation bias.
Yeah.
And we talked about, did you listen to the recording of it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, what we were talking about then was that when you have a faith-based confirmation bias, you just can't see what other people see.
That must be true on two sides.
Well, that's what a confirmation. That's what a confirmation bias is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, but it's the idea of having an inviting someone who doesn't think like this.
I don't mind.
Do you think they change their mind?
No. Yeah, I mean, I don't expect anyone to change their mind about anything.
No.
But is it too controversial, aggressive? Is it too?
It would be interesting.
Cruel.
It would be very interesting.
Someone actually approached me, and who is scientifically convinced that 9/11 was an inside job.
Oh, that would be very interesting.
And is willing to come and defend his position.
Good choice.
So, is that something that the group would
That'd be
like
fine.
To?
Yeah.
There's no problem with.
You know, do you remember when I had brought a friend Gene, and he was talking about the out of Africa hypothesis, uh-huh. and he just didn't accept it, uh-huh. but he had no evidence.
Right.
And we, all of us, basically said, and actually there is now evidence that that there might not be an out of Africa hypothesis, uh-huh. some new evidence. But Gene didn't have that evidence. He wasn't presenting that evidence, and all the evidence we had at that time suggested that the original human beings came out of Africa, and he just had a different idea and couldn't give a reason. And a lot of us said that's just not an acceptable way to think for us. And he was hurt. He thought that he was unwelcome back here, which isn't true. So I'm just a little bit concerned that you bring
that is
in...
my concern.
They need to understand that they're going to be disagreed with.
Oh, yeah.
Not personally attacked,
yes.
not their character attacked, yeah. not being called liar, but they're just going to be told they're wrong yeah. or that somebody else thinks they're wrong,
yeah.
and that has to be okay.
Yes, okay.
But I'm sure...
So if that's the case, why would they do it?
Well, they're convinced they're right. They think they can make their argument to us. That's fine.
Even the Flat Earth Society has a lot of members now, do you know that?
Yeah, it's growing, isn't it?
Do you know they just had a meeting?
There's one right here in
Haiti. Oh, is there?
Yeah.
The what?
Flat Earth Society. Yeah, how would they defend their...
They, have you seen their theories? Very sophisticated.
The Flat Earth people?
Yeah. It's all to do with optics and... Yeah.
Well, they just had a conference, and I read some
That's right. There was hundreds of people there.
Yeah, and I just read something... from them, what they have to say. They consider NASA a hoax. They consider...
Yeah.
They consider all science a hoax, right?
Yeah, it's all hoaxes.
As they dispersed, they sort of fell off, didn't they, on the edges?
The funny thing I read about that conference was the people flew from all over the world to get to it. That's pretty funny, isn't it?
they couldn't see the...
no horizon, eh?
They didn't know high enough.
Well, here's...
They have an argument.
If the Earth was flat, wouldn't it all be in daylight at the same time and all be in nighttime at the same time?
Exactly.
Every Friday, you can clearly see.
They will explain it.
Yes.
They'll explain it somehow.
There's a dark side to this.
So
somewhere.
Is that a
It's a little disconcerting that there's so many people willing to think this way.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how many flat earthers there are, but the climate deniers and the ones that are doubling down on their president, there's just... I don't know if you
there was an interesting article about that, that the more highly educated Republicans
are more likely to deny
climate change.
I saw that. And do you know that Roy Moore's support in Alabama is stronger than it was before this scandal? What's going on?
For God's sake.
What's going on?
Yeah.
I mean,
something in the water.
What's going on? You can tolerate 2 or 5% of your neighbors thinking like this, but when it gets to be 30 or 40%, there's trouble.
Yeah.
Those people are easily led by the nose.
Yes.
Well, that's how or Trump. Religion by the nose.
Well, with faith they think in it isn't limited to religion.
I like Philip's idea. I think it would be fun to have a really controversial subject matter come up. I didn't think it was all that controversial, actually, but to have somebody try to defend a position like that. Like I told Philip, he's going to be in charge. He needs to stop us from attacking the person too badly.
Because it's your person.
Well, okay, I got a confession. If we have this conversation, I'm not convinced either.
You're not going to what?
I'm not convinced.
About?
That it wasn't an inside job.
Okay.
I'm not saying that it was.
Well, good.
What does that have to do with...
I'm talking about 9/11. No, I'm saying I'm not convinced. I have two hypotheses. I have two conspiracy theories.
This isn't 9/11, is it? This is, we didn't really land on the moon?
No. This is, the gentleman who contacted me is a 9/11.
The 9/11 conspiracy.
Yeah,
believe
it. Yeah,
inside
theory.
The moon theory is... Correct.
Yeah, that's another one.
That's
they say it was all shot in the studio. Well, what's the argument against that?
It's like Dawkins when he talks about a little teapot on the other side of the moon, eh?
You can't disprove it.
He can't disprove it.
Yeah. Russell's the orbiting teapot.
Yeah.
Well, no, I think we can disprove it. I think we can prove, we have very convincing evidence that it wasn't a fraud. For one thing, the Soviets. If we didn't send something up to the moon, they would have ratted us out. They were probably tracking the spaceship all the way.
Like the video game thing that they just posted, saying that we bombed ISIS instead of
what?
You're saying the Soviets, there was a recent thing about us being bad about messing up bombing against ISIS and everything in that part of the world. And the actual video clip that they put up was a video clip from a
video game.
From a game.
Oh. Fake news.
And it was taken down rapidly afterwards. Somebody made a mistake, but to get it to that point has to go through so many steps to post something from a video game.
Shows how good our video games are.
I've never seen a video game that looked like a photograph.
Because the video, so many of those are a war-based video game. They actually took that. They made modifications to block faces and substitute. But the people that had played the game real well outed it, like, as soon as it came out.
Well, good. That would be a good example, because if you're going to try to defraud people, there's a great chance that somebody's going to know you are and rat you.
Because I think it's like people will take the path of least resistance, Like, I worked in the Romania just after the fall of communism. And, when I got there, people told me that, Romanians, they were flight. They actually invented the telephone.
Oh.
They told me all kinds of things. I went, you don't believe this. But they did.
But that's what they did.
Well, I guess
that's exactly.
They had control over the news they got.
Yes.
I have a curiosity, just something I wanted to ask. For a long time, I had this belief as the internet evolved, and I still think people are this way. As a whole, we make better decisions with good information. Whatever the population, the source, the concern, if you have good information, you make better decisions. But what I've seen is the proliferation of data out there that you can have any opinion and go find something to support it. As far as the internet evolving, that didn't allow us to step up our game and it used to be more diverse, more divisive because we could find anybody that would lie to us.
Everybody today is their own editor.
Why?
it used to be true. It used to be true that the information quality was higher, but now other actors have gotten into the game, and professional people
liars.
Who liars, professional liars,
yeah. Yeah.
And now the information is almost totally untrustworthy unless you're willing to dig deeper than whatever the headlines say.
Yeah, you have to bet it yourself.
If you're not willing to go further than whatever's on the front page and the headline, you are totally misinformed.
But our news sources have been bought by large interests or conglomerations.
That's
they're
the
not
problem.
News sources anymore. They're punditry.
That's right.
It's
that's
their
the problem.
Opinion.
It
whatever.
Used to be better. Yes, it's gotten much worse.
Yes.
So how do we nudge things?
Yes.
You have to dig deeper.
We have to dig deeper to get an answer. But I mean,
right.
How do we
you
influence
to
things to be a little more honest?
Think you
have to
look
at the
First Amendment.
Time it takes.
Do you remember
yeah.
the fairness?
Perhaps
not.
Yes.
Because
yes.
it's just
so
easy to
be
what's out there without having
not
thinking of your own.
For news was a loss leader, and they just accepted that. News didn't generate ratings because news was supposed to be
educational.
Impartial, and everybody accepted that until they discovered with CNN
right.
at the beginning or whatever that news could generate a lot.
And there was a clear separation of news and editorial.
And entertainment.
And
then they actually turned the news into entertainment.
Well, yeah, many of my news sources are comedians. Bill Maher,
right.
Jimmy Kimmel, Trevor Howard, not Trevor Howard, that's an actor. Trevor Noah.
John Oliver.
John Oliver, I like him.
John Oliver.
And comedians, they're news pastors. They're the only people speaking truth to power.
You really have to dig now. You have to first read the headline, then read the story, then see if the people in the story actually said what they said. And then have to see if their sources are reliable. It's going to come full circles. It started with, we have trustworthy news sources, then everybody got into the game, and it's going to come circle again where we're going to have to go back to trustworthy news sources. And because right now, you don't know who to trust.
Yes.
But people like the fact that they don't know who to trust because they can validate their own thinking by saying, oh, I read on the internet.
Did you say I read it in the newspaper?
Well, yesterday I gave the LCS TED Talk, and it was Michael Shermer's Why People Believe Weird Things.
Oh.
And the entire audience basically was, you know, believers in magical thinking.
Really?
And I don't know whether the lakeside attracts them, whether there's a higher proportion.
It's the current culture.
Is it just the culture? I mean, is it
culture.
Just changed because I'm here and I'm not aware that it's increased elsewhere?
It's current culture.
But I was just amazed at what I was hearing.
Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
People
they
just that's, they read
the
128 characters, and that's the story.
There was one
Short
question
where
I asked everyone to. I don't know whether you've ever seen this, where you put your hands together really tight, and it was to demonstrate the presence of chi, and they said you can concentrate. The chi in your, and this was taught to me by a healer, in your hands, and then you put your hands out, and you put your fingers out, and because of, you know, your muscles are exhausted, they slowly come together, and you say, look, can you feel the attraction? Can you feel them bonding? In fact, you can't even stop them, you know, stop them touching. And they went, yeah. And they said, well, okay, so that proves that there's chi energy, right? I mean, I've just demonstrated it to you. And the healer told me, well, yeah. And I went, well, actually, that was taught to me by a stage hypnotist who used to use this test to find out who were the most gullible. And then he would pick those from the audience and say, yeah, I thought. And that was his selection process.
I was going to tell you that was a bunch of crap because I thought, what the hell is he talking about?
But it is, you know, I mean, it does happen. It's just you know, when you put your arm against a wall,
push
up.
Yeah.
And you can add any explanation you like. But they were all buying it, and it was just like,
so
no.
Why did they believe? So why do
you get the fake news?
Because, it, you know, it's fallacy of, you know, the authority. I was at the front, I was speaking authoritatively, and they go, yeah.
They're not well-trained in critical thinking.
Yes,
no.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. I think that...
It's a skill.
Because you can say, okay, there is this chi or whatever they call it, energy.
Yeah.
Okay, is it measurable? Can it act in some way, affect something, you know, in nature? No. It's just something that is in their minds. Right, they can do the scientific
rationalizing
method. Can they do the scientific method, you know?
Yeah.
They have their hypothesis in trying to do the experiments.
Even after I told them this was just, you know, just fake, and it was, you know, it was a perfectly rational
it's amazing
biological explanation. This woman said, no, that actually was a demonstration, and I know it's real, because I held my father's hand when he was dying. At the moment that he died, he got smaller and I got slightly larger. As his energy passed
from. His energy.
I said, well, did you do any measurements? Did you?
Yes.
And she says, well, it seemed that way. And I said, well, that's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, no. You've got all the things that are not true that come out of the media, but then you've got the Trump situation. Practically everything he says is a lie. But whenever there is an undisputed fact that goes against him, is it fake news?
That's right.
Fake news.
That's
a wonderful, wonderful expression. It's doing him a lot of good.
Yeah.
We've got to get critical thinking back in people's brains.
Yeah.
Yes.
Civics also. And I took that out of high school. That a lot of people don't even know how the government's supposed to work. So anything that Trump or these people say, they believe. They don't even know how things are supposed to work. So they don't know he's blowing through all the norms like crazy.
They don't even know what government means.
That's right.
I thought it was McGovern.
Aren't there any incentive for people to teach critical thinking in schools? As it's a challenge to the people.
Should be a requirement.
Yeah, but it's a challenge to the people who are in power.
It's a challenge. Texas, at one time, actually took that out, said that they could not teach critical thinking in elementary schools and
Texas.
Yeah,
they give a reason.
The school board actually, they're always trying to take out evolution, they're always trying to change, make sure there's no climate change stuff, and so they wanted to take out the sections on critical thinking skills. And they actually took it out at one point. I don't know if it's back by now.
That was the foundation of my education, critical thinking, for my bachelor's and my master's degree in liberal arts. That's the number one thing that they teach you. Critical thinking. That's the base. And then you take
College was supposed to be all about, right? You learn how to learn. You learn how to think. You learn how to
question.
People in power
come up out. You question everything.
And what do we do? We pull money out of the education system every time somebody needs to pay a bill.
Have you heard this before? Science are questions that may never be answered. Religion are answers that may never be questioned.
Yes, I've heard that before.
There's quite a few of those.
I can't live on Coke alone.
Like the one you have on your car.
Right.
Is that one Coke you use?
Yeah.
All right.
There you go.
I think it's time.
Yeah. All right. I'm sorry.